folks, we have hit the finale of season 6 of Mention and Dispatches here. I have no idea what episode number we ended up with. 13, 14, maybe. I'm not really sure. I think it's 13. BB Mike was supposed to be keeping track. Mike, what number episode do we think we're on?
I think you're right. I think we've hit the teens. I think it just is 13 or 14.
Yeah, somewhere right around there. But we are calling it the end of season 6 here, and so we're gonna have a nice, fun, hearty wargaming chat tonight, and then take the summer off and come back and do it all again in the fall. And joining us tonight for that wonderful, hearty chat of all things wargaming, our good buddy Cyrano. Jim, how are you doing tonight?
I am doing very well. Good evening to all and sundry.
Yes, thank you, and glad to have you here with us. And our buddy OJ's dad, the other Mike, so you're getting snowed on. Is that what we are to understand?
Yeah, it was like 8:30. It was just barely light out, and it's snowing.
Yeah, so after Easter, you've still got the snow coming down.
Yep, 3 weeks after Easter, and then by this time next week, we're supposed to be about 80 again.
Yep. Well, I... you know, look, if we had Vance on the call, he'd be telling us how much more miserable he is. So,
well, he's north of the border. So,
yeah,
that just goes without saying.
Yes. Well, and people wonder why I continue to refer to them as north of the wall. So
right now it is a wall practically.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty much that. So we've had a pretty good couple of months of wargaming here, even though we've all been sort of locked down. I mean, post-Christmas throughout this podcast season, we've had a wide variety of entertaining game-ishness to keep us busy. I do want to ask, because Jim was a part of it, as we are recording this, Connections Online was last week, and Jim, you joined us for two different parts of Connections Online. You were a part of one of the panels, and you allowed us to redirect Wednesday Night Warfare into an event for those guys for Men Against Fire. Which one do you want to tackle first? Just like a little feedback impressions from you.
Well, we certainly talk about the panel, because I had the opportunity to be on the panel with folks that with Gail and Eliza, two ladies that I'd never met before. And we talked about distributed gaming over the long haul, over the long term. And I made the comment to you, Brent, when you first broached the idea to me that, you know, maybe there's a little bit of a disconnect, but it really did strike me that, first, and I'll say it here, I say it everywhere, I said it on the panel, Dungeons & Dragons First Edition was a war game. D&D still is a war game at its root when you play it the right way. And the false dichotomy that's grown up between RPG players and war gamers is just nonsensical. And it was a real pleasure to sit down and talk about how you keep a war game, a role-playing game alive over a long term, over a long distance, when you can't all meet together in the same space. And we faced, yes, there were a lot of differences. There were a lot of differences about how I go about doing a Kriegspiel or something like that, and how they go about their, you know, their games in the Thulu universe and all that. But we also saw a lot of similarities, and that was really cool.
And I think, for audience context, one of the reasons why this panel was put together, the Connections Conference is oriented towards wargaming practitioners, folks that are using wargaming in a professional capacity, whether it's a training capacity or a training, teaching, or an analytical capacity, or some sort of rehearsal or developmental capacity. So it's a lot of DoD national security types, bunch of academics. And for a lot of those guys, big wargaming events necessitate the coming together of lots of people. They bring everybody together. They do a bunch of stuff for a week really intently, and then they scatter and they go off and they do other things. And when the pandemic hit, we sort of gathered around Zoom, because that's what we do these days. But we never really reconceived any of those larger DoD style war games as something that could be done over the long haul instead of just a really intense event over the course of a single week. And so that's why Jim and Gail and Elisa were brought in to talk about keeping those campaigns together over the long haul. And Jim, I think the big difference with you versus them is the nature of their RPG campaigns versus your Kriegspiels sort of necessitate gathering everyone together, even virtually, but synchronously, right? They've all got to be on the call together to really get through their RPG sessions. Whereas for the Kriegspiel, you kind of don't want everybody on there together at the same time because they're all getting different information. They're all in different places and seeing different things.
That's absolutely right. No, it's part of the shared storytelling. And that's not to say that you can't play a Kriegspiel face-to-face in a certain way, but certainly the way we're doing distributed, it's almost entirely asynchronous. I don't think the group has ever been together on anything more than a chain of emails. So, and there isn't the shared storytelling experience of being in a room and confronting a challenge and, you know, trying to solve a situation that you get in a face-to-face RPG. No, absolutely. That's right.
Yeah. I think one of the cool things to come out of it all is that both of the ladies would like to join us at Origins for a Kriegspiel at some point. So I think that's cool. And,
as we made clear, we would love to have them.
And Men Against Fire on Wednesday night, showing off Tabletop Simulator, but showing off a different kind of game that some of the practitioners may not be familiar with. And really, Men Against Fire is almost sort of, I mean, we're back to role-playing, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, in fact, if you read Patty Griffith's introduction to Men Against Fire, it's in his book of Sandhurst War Games, which you will find in many half-price books across the country, but you will never find the insert map and pieces.
It at some public libraries across the country also.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No. It must have had a very, very broad release, but the insert with the maps, charts, tables, pieces are typically missing.
Those have been gone since 1984.
right. I bought two of them remotely before I finally got one, and I had a third one given to me as a gift because somebody knew I was looking for it. And look, I got it for you. And how do you tell somebody that's so kind that you're desperately waiting to open it up and not show your intense disappointment when the insert isn't there?
Yeah.
So I finally did get one. So no, it's the strangest game in the set. The other games in the set are far more traditional. Hex Encounter and area movement, things that wargamers would immediately recognize. This is, as Patty says in his introduction to the rules, a crossbreed between a miniatures game. His original was played with counters and with paper or card parts, and an RPG. It's a board war game and an RPG, a miniatures game. And it's a blind because the players play unable to see the board. I've built a board. I've built pieces, and you give people the ability to march over that board and respond to things, but they don't get to see any of it. They just have to have it described to them like an umpire does in a role-playing game. And they then have to provide simple reactions, and it's timed. And this was a scenario based again in the summer of 1944. Not that that particularly matters because everything's fairly abstract. And some of the fun is that the people who got to watch it online, the viewers who watched it on the YouTube broadcast and since, they get to see what the players couldn't. So they get to watch them fumbling about in the dark, embarrassing themselves. And, you know, everybody took it. But this was a wonderful group. We had four players, all of them new to the experience. And the underlying premise of the game, S.L.A. Marshall, wrote a book called Men Against Fire, which is where it's from, in which, among a lot of other things, he hypothesized that the vast majority of men in combat and the bullets that they fire never get close to the enemy. That the vast, and he probably would have run that percentage to something like 90%. And so each one of the players is assigned a particular soldier, and each one of those soldiers is assigned a particular role that isn't revealed to those that he's playing with. And the majority of the players aren't fighters. They're specifically, in fact, going to avoid combat once the fighting starts. And part of the joy of the game is watching the commander try to sort out who he can count on and who he can't. We had one guy playing his role brilliantly who spent much of this battle. There was a tank, spent much of the battle hugging the treads of the tank. Yes, I'm right here, Sarge. Right here, Sarge. Ready to go. All set. Ready to go. You just tell me where, Sarge. And yet every time it came down to it, he was nowhere near available.
Yeah. Got to tie my shoes, Sarge.
Yeah, boy. Yeah, that sounds like a real problem. Should I look into that? And so dealing with that and dealing with the game, we brought it in a little over 2 hours. So no, it was, and, the folks all said they had a good time and wanted to try some more. So, no, it was a fun, busy Wednesday.
I hope we've got a couple of potential tentative converts for Saturday Night Fights to join the hilarity there. Mike, while we were off conferencing last week, dealing with connection stuff and, you know, Jim dealing with his day job, which kept him out of part of connections, what kind of gaming did you guys have going on last week? And we'll start with Mike. Whichever Mike unmikes is Mike first can tell us what were you playing last week? OJ's Stellaris. Dad, start with you.
Stellaris.
Stellaris.
Yep. New update came out. The 3.0 update came out on Thursday.
And what is that update colloquially known as?
Dick.
I'm sorry.
He's not kidding.
Yeah.
It's the one that was inspired by Philip K. Dick.
Ah.
So it is known as the Dick update. Mike just wanted to say the word Dick on the air.
No, you just wanted me to. Let's be honest here, right? It was more you than me.
We're not on broadcast radio. We can get away with all kinds of stuff. All right. So what exactly – what does the Dick give you?
Optimization in some ways. They're trying to get the whole automated management of planets a lot more streamlined. I think that's probably the biggest thing that they're focused on. I think – BB Mike, do you have Stellaris?
I do.
Yeah. What else? Honestly, I
wait a second. You actually asked BB Mike if he had a Space 4X game. Really? Well, is this your first time here?
Yeah. Well,
It's fair to ask whether or not he picked up the update. Like, I get that, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not even sure that's a fair question for me because of course I have the update.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't have all the race packs until last week either. So.
Yeah, but I suppose the fair question for BB Mike would be, have you played it?
I have not. I fired up the new update, but I have not really played it. I just kind of looked around, noticed that some of my mods were missing or wouldn't work, and just kind of backed right back out.
I was actually surprised that a lot of my mods within about 2 or 3 days were being updated to 3.0.
Yeah, some of those guys are pretty quick to respond to that.
Same now, whether or not some of them still need to be optimized or have some changes made to take advantage of some of the new features, I'm not sure yet.
Okay.
Here's a couple of the neat new features is if you form the Galactic Council, you have a chance of leading it, and not just leading it, but declaring yourself the Emperor over all these races.
Whoa.
And then the other side of it is you can be the bad guys. You can be the Galactic Threat.
You know, as anybody who has seen Star Wars knows, the Empire are the bad guys.
Well,
according to many.
Democracy ended with the sound of applause, right?
Yes. Right. With thunderous applause. So in the – as you were firing up the new update for Stellaris, were you – I'm assuming that necessitated starting a campaign from scratch rather than just applying the update to an existing ongoing campaign. I don't know of any big game that gives you an update like that and lets you just update a campaign in stride.
Started a couple of new games, actually. In fact, I was just playing 10 minutes ago.
Oh, crap. It's time for a podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, why not? So out of the new features for Stellaris, what do you like most? What do you like least of the little bit that you've played with it at this point?
I don't know. I think they're doing a better job of having the AI manage your planets for you.
Okay.
That's a big thing, especially if you want a large map, right? Most 4X, not just 4X, but you know, most of these type of empire building games, it almost seems like they're geared toward you micromanaging everything. A lot of them don't seem to understand that, hey, you get so big, you don't want to micromanage. Give me the tools, give me the AI that can do this for me. So I don't have to click on 120 planets to do something.
Yeah.
You know, give me a tool set that I can say, do this on these 20 planets.
Yeah. Yeah, I could totally see that.
And I've been kicking around Civ 6 with you guys.
I think it's just me of these guys.
Well, I meant some of the other dragoons.
Well, no, I get you. I just had to check for a second because there are a bunch of different ones going on, and had to make sure. So, my love of all things Civ is hardly a secret. This is Civ 6 has been out a year and a half, 2 years now. It's been out a little while now, but I just finally was able to get a computer strong enough to run it. pretty much. So you guys all have a head start on me at this point.
Honestly, yeah, I the final patch for that, sir.
Is that right? That they offered some terminal patch just in time for Brant to get it?
Well, so the rumor is this is the final patch for Civilization. There's a big, if you've been over to Civ Fanatics and there's kind of a discussion over there, it's like somebody let it slip that perhaps this is the last patch. So who knows? Well,
it's the last update for the New Frontier Pass. Right.
Well, that's what the last thing was said on the forums until like today. Apparently, one of the designers was off on some German podcast or something and said, and let slip that this is the final patch for Civilization VI. And so that ignited a big debate. So, is it really the last patch for Civilization
VI? So Civ VI was released in October of 2016. So it's 5.5 years old.
It's been a while. Okay.
Yeah. And honestly, until I started getting into these multiplayer games, I hadn't really done much with it either on single player.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I just could not get into it as a single player game for some reason.
Well, what were those other kind of games you mentioned?
What's that?
You said single player. What was the other thing you mentioned? I didn't understand that.
Yeah, you see.
For some reason, I couldn't get into Civ 6 as a single player game for some reason.
Yeah, because, you know, who does that? Really? I mean, plays by themselves and doesn't engage their friend. Oh, no, Mike and I have a friendly disagreement on this topic.
I know.
Actually, I'm not even sure we disagree that much. We should have had another podcast where we discussed that.
yeah, maybe, an entire podcast. Maybe next season. To see just exactly, you know, it's funny. I mean, Civ and I go all the way back. I mean, we go all the way back. Which is Metal Dogs, by the way? It's 4, right?
He's in love with 4.
Right. Yeah, because he's just there. And I don't know. I should, you know, and it and I go way, way back. And I have certainly given many, many hundreds of hours to it. But it is certainly also something that has drifted away from my affections. It's very interesting to watch you all play this. And I hope there will be AARs because perhaps that will rekindle my interest.
I am hoping to get far enough into fully understanding the ways in which 6 manages different things that I'm going to try and pull together one of my long AARs again for a 6 game, but probably for a solo game just because the multiplayer games can be a little choppy as you're handing the turn off from person to person to person. Sure. And we're not all necessarily on well synchronized schedules to where we can get 3 or 4 or 5 turns in a row. And so that starts to cut into what you can realistically kind of do. So
tell the truth.
Yeah, and we had
I was just going to say there are 2 levels of Civ players. And I suppose this is true of a lot of games. There are guys out there that will go in and gals, forgive me, that go in there and they're going to shove the pieces around and they're going to figure out, maybe they'll look at the odds ratios and they'll figure stuff out and they'll, oh, look at this. This is cool. I'm going to throw this. I'm going to develop archers. And that's it. That's what they do. And then there are the people that get out their crowbar, pry under the hood and really try to understand how the game works and how the game thinks so they can try to master the system.
Absolutely.
Who in that multiplayer game is the worst of – who is the worst of the latter?
Vance, probably.
And to be fair, though, he's the most experienced of us with Civ 6. I don't know if he fully falls into that category. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Yeah, could be a good player and just not overanalyze every detail that how the system's going to react to what you're doing. So you're saying he's probably more of just a good player.
Yeah, but there's a lot of depth to Civ 6. You can have religious victories. You can have cultural victories. And so it's, you know, so Vance understands some of those aspects of it that the rest of us are still trying to wrap our heads around and learn and so forth.
Yeah, a couple of the oddities to it. There's there's now the ability for religious, there are multiple kinds of religious units. There's not just missionaries, right? You don't just, you know, build your prophets to create your new religion and then start launching missionaries. There are a couple of different types of religious units. So there are missionaries or apostles or gurus or whatever. And okay. So they can spread religion in different ways. They can also have, they can act as sort of healers or they do fill other roles. But then there's also theological combat. I'm not really sure. I get the concept behind it, but I'm not really sure what that would actually look like on the ground. Like if you showed up and observed a bout of theological combat between apostles of two opposing religions, what does that look like?
Well, I will tell you what it looks like.
Obama throwdown?
Just play Here I Stand.
Yeah.
The Protestant forces never wind up with much by the way of armies, but there's a phase every turn where they have to fight to flip zones, from Catholic to Protestant, from Protestant to Reformed, things like that. So it exists.
Yeah. Now this, I guess it's a giant Yo Prophet throwdown or something. I'm not really sure what they're doing there. I do find the concept very interesting, and it does add a different level of depth to the way in which you move things around. I think there's a lot of really neat subsystems to it that I am enjoying exploring the way in which they play out against each other.
Do you have all of the expansion packs?
I think the only thing I'm missing is like the Frontier Pass stuff that was just released like 6 weeks ago. Maybe I think is the only thing that I'm missing at this point.
Hmm.
So,
and I don't have that either. So you're not the only one.
Yeah. It's been fun so far. I'm not super far into it, but it's been a lot of fun so far. And, you know, we're only what, like 10 turns into the one multiplayer that Mike and I are both in. So it's not like we're real deep into this at this point yet.
Yeah. Maybe 15 or 20, I would say. Yeah. We have had a couple of issues with the cloud based multiplayer. In fact, our last game, something happened. Well, I think it happened because of a update that came out where not everybody was in sync with the updates, and it screwed up the game somehow. And that's how we ended up restarting last week.
Is that what happened?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We were like 130, 150 turns in, and something got out of sync somehow.
Okay.
And we couldn't figure out how to save it. Civ 6 is very much to me a computerized board game. It just has that feel to it. And I think somebody made the comment, that's why Metal Dog doesn't like anything after 4, because the maps are so small.
You can set some pretty enormous maps for 5. I think from 4 to 5, there was a complete reimagining of a lot of the cultural developments that I think rubbed him a little bit the wrong way. I don't want to put too many words in his mouth.
I haven't asked him about it either. One of the other guys that's playing just said that he thought it was the map size that was kind of a turnoff for him.
It was my impression, and this, I too want to be very careful. I thought he also didn't like the way they changed the stacking rules.
No, that happened between 3 and 4.
Okay.
I think. I think 4 was the one that got rid of the mountains of death.
Oh, no. 4 has stacks of doom.
4 does have stacks of doom. Okay. I know 5 does not, because 5, you've got to be real particular, sometimes playing sort of your attacks on cities almost become a bit of a side game of Tetris, trying to sequence everything in so that they hit properly and then get out of the way of the guy coming behind so that next hit can hit the city. In 5, you really have to pile on the cities to be able to take them down as you're attacking. So
yeah, to do this, the stacks. So didn't you have to have like Beyond the Sword expansion?
Could have been. I didn't get that far into it. I had vanilla 4. So. I didn't like it. I went back to playing 3. So
Well, and Mike, can I go back to your point very quickly? I think it was dead on point. Is that it is a board game.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of goes to my point about lifting the hood to see what's going on underneath. One of the things that fascinates me now, and I'm really getting interested in this, is when board games, because if you've been watching what's happening with board games, and I don't even mean just war games, because we're our own little cul-de-sac and we're going to stay where we are. But I'm talking games like Twilight Imperium, you know, Twilight Imperium, what is it, 32 or whatever it's on right now. And I'm trying to think of some of these other games that have come out. Solomon Kane, which is still remaining unboxed, although I'm looking through the rules. And some of these other really, really complex tabletop games. And I know, Brent, we've talked about it. Some of these games come and look at our war games and go, oh, that's so terribly complex. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
But
you've got a 64-page exceptions book.
Right. You know? Right. Or you've got a set of rules. Well, like you say, you've got a set of rules to explain your rules. So they've got all that. I am very, very curious to see where the breaking point is where people are like, wait a minute, why am I not having a computer do this?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there is, well, shoot, they put out, it's funny, Europa Universalis, we all know, was originally a board game, right? So this same company that does Stellaris puts out Europa Universalis, Europa Universalis 2 being one of the greatest computer games ever made. I was obsessed with it. In some ways, I still am. It has never been exceeded by any of its successors. And all of a sudden, they're now doing a Kickstarter, or they have done a Kickstarter, for a board game iteration of the thing. And I'm going, why are you trying to put that back on the tabletop?
So that we're clear, so Paradox are the guys that do the computer games. And it's our buddy Uwe over at Academy Games that did the Stellaris tabletop game.
Right. And it's like, yeah. Why, you know, and especially with Europa Universalis, why would you ever try to put that back on the tabletop? What sort of weird unself-aware masochism are you dealing with and need to get on a couch for to make you want to play this without computer assistance?
Well, I think looking at the Stellaris board game, it looks like it's a very simplified version of the.
But the very fact that you said that Uwe's doing it tells me that, of course, it is. He doesn't do complex games; he just doesn't.
And that's not a criticism. It's just a different take, right? But but you're right, and you're right, Jim. I mean, that's the difference, right? Paradox took this game and they've expanded it in not as a criticism, but they've made it a lot more in depth, a lot more complex. But in doing so, they're using the computer to take a lot of that work off the player, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You're taking something like Stellaris or Europa Universalis. I'm not even drinking tonight either. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, you take that and you go back to a board game with it, and you have to cut out so much that it is not the same game. I don't care what you say. It's a very light version of the computer game, because like you said, the computer is doing so much more. And so my question is, are the people that buy these games, are they unaware of what's available on what we call the war game side? Because I would say that instead of buying Stellaris, the board game, go buy Space Empires 4X. I guarantee you that's a better game. And I haven't even played the board game version of Stellaris, but I guarantee you that's a better game.
Speaking of board games, I've gotten into Starfire. I'm doing a multiplayer Starfire game.
Cool.
Which has roots all the way back into what, the 70s, late 70s?
But no, and that's and where I really got into this, I was playing, I got into a thing. Somebody online said, hey, do you want to play all? Oh, it was one of the Dragoons who I haven't spoken to in a while. I really got to fix that. And he wanted to play all of the John Tiller Software World War I squad battle games. Mirrors. He wanted to just go through all the scenarios and play them mirrored. And so we would each play, you know, he'd play one, he'd play the Turks, I'd play the Germans, he'd play the British, I'd then play the Turks, you know, you get it.
Yeah.
And I remember the thing with the Tiller games, and it, no matter what the guys at Three Moves Ahead think, the interface is fine. By the time you're good at the interface, you are clicking so fast. And it dawned on me as I was doing that, my God, the math this game is doing in a single click. Mm-hmm. You know, and I went back and I thought about all the squad battle World War II games. I thought about the Panzer Battle games, which are different from the Panzer campaigns. Panzer Battles are set at the same level as Panzer Blitz and Panzer Leader, whereas Panzer Campaigns is a level up. And I thought about all these games. And I'm like, you know, I'm looking at it's Hexes and Counters, even though they're digital. The maps are bigger than anything I'd ever be able to really set up, practically speaking. And then when I want to, I don't know.
We've seen the Kriegspiel map. We know that's not true.
And then I know that, you know, BB Mike is sitting over there in his bunker, you know, hiding out his Pioneer. And I got my Pioneer squad and I brought them up and they got this much fatigue and this much range and they're at this height and this weapon's effectiveness. And instead of having to go through 30 tables, 30 charts, running down the whole thing, I double click and it gives me a result,
yeah.
You know, and including a random factor, may I note. And so I'm not saying don't play things on the tabletop, not at all. I'm just wondering where that cutoff point is where we're going to start saying to tabletop games, okay, you're done here. I'm going over to a computer to handle this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the things that the tabletop games give you the ability in not being able to crunch every possible number, you learn to live with some abstractions, but you also develop some elegant ways around some of those abstractions to create some of those abstractions, which I think is nice. I think there are some times where some of the computer things just almost seem a little too much kitchen sinkish, right? We're throwing it all in because we can, not because we need to. Not because it really in any way materially affects what's happening in the game. Yeah, the fact that we can account for this, we're going to. And
Gary Grigsby feels seen by your unkind, yes, remark.
And he should, quite frankly. And we had this conversation last week, 2 weeks ago, whenever it was, we had Brian on here and we were talking about war in the East and where did all my trucks go? What do you mean my divisions didn't bring their trucks with them from the Western Front? As though a division's gonna, you know, just load up and head east and go, oh crap, we forgot our trucks, you know. So there are some things that people put in there because they can, not because they necessarily need to be there or because they add any real legitimate value to what it is you're trying to have the players do. And I think there's a lot of times where, and this is probably me putting my software design hat from, you know, my long running day job back on a little bit. What is that there to do for you? And does it need to be there? There was a great session. This was actually at a connection session some 10, 11, 12 years ago when people were talking about how much complexity to put in professional games. And Chris Weave, who was the chair of this connections, was talking about something that Paul Weber used to talk about a lot. Paul Weber is another longtime connections hand. And this thing Paul used to have was the robots with buckets of lava rule. In Star Wars 3, Revenge of the Sith, the big fight on the lava planet when they're zipping around on floating rock and skimmers and whatever else, and somehow magically not catching on fire despite being 7 inches above the lava. In the background of one of them, there are robots that are like moving buckets of molten lava around. To what end, right? What purpose is being served by robots moving buckets of molten lava around? Those are there because the CGI guys could create them and they wanted something in the background so it didn't look completely vacant. But in the long run, like, if you take Anakin and Obi-Wan out of the sword fight and just watch robots moving around buckets of molten lava, where are they going with them? Like, what happens next? Great, I got buckets of molten lava. Now what do I do with them? And so you put stuff in there because you can. Did you really need to? Like, what's the actual purpose being served by these things? And so maybe that's one of those cases where some of the computer gamers can dial it back a little bit and consider that some elegance and simplification can help you get at the core of what it is you're really trying to do. James Sterrett talked about exactly that with the Hold Fast Korea game and some of the students at the School for Advanced Military Studies when we had him on the podcast a couple weeks ago, talking about some of the studies out at Fort Leavenworth. And the SAMS guys, when they first put a board game on the table, they're thinking, holy cow, how can a board game actually give me the level of detail that I'm really looking for in all of this? And they realized very quickly that it did, because it took away all the extra crap that you didn't really need to think about to focus on the important decisions of that campaign. So
yeah, no, I'm going to be fascinated to watch this as board games, because obviously board games are now very, very big business. And there's a, you know, while a lot of our war game leaders, I would say Uwe and David Thompson, friend of Armchair Dragoons, and a number of other people are driving for simplicity, there's still a lot of board games, you know, that aren't necessarily war themed, that are heading in a direction of remarkable levels of complexity that I'm wondering why aren't they being offloaded? And then when I see things like, as I say, Europa Universalis, or, and don't we have a Civilization game floating around somewhere that is heading, and I don't mean Advanced Civ, which is a whole different creature.
No. It pretty much you've everything you have discussed somehow manages to involve Fantasy Flight games.
Okay.
They're the ones behind Twilight Imperium. They're the ones that did the Civ board game reboot, which is actually a fairly remarkable game, but it does feel very much like you're playing Civ Lite, which you have to if you're going to put it on a tabletop. So, you know, you pull out something like Warrior Knights or Descent or Runebound, pretty much anything not Arkham Horror, and Fantasy Flight games turn into these voluminous spreads. I will say, you know, you were talking about the different versions of Twilight Imperium. There are still fewer versions of Twilight Imperium than you had episodes of Leipzig.
Wow. And suddenly you fight dirty. What is this?
I'm not wrong.
No. Did I say you were? I don't believe so.
Brant, I understand what you're saying about, you know, are you just including the kitchen sink? Do you really need trucks in there and so forth? I'd counter that, though, by saying, as an example, the Eastern Front, right, of World War II. Mm-hmm. There's how many games that tackle that at about the same level, right?
Oh, yeah.
And they all have varying levels. I think the other part of it is, you know, you sit there and you say, well, did you really need to throw this in? Well, what was the purpose of putting it in? Are they trying to get the players? Yeah. One, you got a certain set of players that really want to have that advanced level. And two, hey, we want people to understand there's a lot of logistics here. You know, it's not just telling this army, this division to go here and fight this guy. It's, you got to manage things. And so I don't consider it a bad thing. It's just know what you're getting into, know what you're buying, and then decide, do I want to try and tackle this?
Yeah. There are absolutely valid reasons to put many of those things in there. And so I don't want people to think that I'm saying that complexity is inherently bad. What does seem to happen quite often is things get thrown in because they can, not because they were intentional design decisions to further a specific goal. And so if things are being put in there to further a specific goal, like, I'm all for it. Let's do it. You know, let's have as much complexity as needed and no more. But unfortunately,
what you're talking about is mission creep.
Yes. Yes. Feature bloat. Yep. And you and I have both seen that in our day jobs.
Oh, yeah.
There's all sorts of feature bloat that you end up with.
But now, are you talking about going from a board game to a computer game?
I'm talking about going from a computer game to a computer game in many cases. Yeah.
Or just a computer game in general.
Okay. Yeah. What Brant's saying is just, you know, they design a game, they put it out on paper, they start building it, and then halfway through building this computer game, they decide, hey, I want to do this and this and this, and they don't always take that step back and say, how's this really fit in? Is this really going to enhance the game? Or is it just a really cool whiz-bang feature that I want to throw into the game?
Yeah. Because I can do the mathematical difference between wool versus polyester sock doesn't necessarily mean that I have to model the difference between wool versus polyester socks when I'm playing a core level war game that spans all of Europe. So, you know, can you do it? Sure. What's the point? Now, if the point is to show that by switching from wool to polyester or vice versa, to outfit your entire, you know, 1.5 million man army has significant economic effects on the home front by suddenly making sheep very scarce, or by making polyester suddenly you're diverting petroleum from other uses. Like, now you've got a valid reason to have it there, and that's fine. You've now made an intentional design decision that, you know, a military logistics type of decision is also going to have second and third order effects in a broader economic model. But if that broader economic model never exists, why the hell are you bothering with the material the socks are made out of? And so that's my point, is that there seem to be times where there are things thrown into, especially computer models, because as Jim mentioned, you can do a ton of math with a single click, that there seem to be times things are thrown into the computer models because they can be, not necessarily because somebody said, this is important to the design of the game for this reason. And that's the more troublesome issue, I think. But I could be wrong. It's not likely, but I could be wrong.
At the end of the day, I'm just more curious. I don't know as I have a strong opinion one way or the other. I will say this about a game that we've actually played, as folks may be aware, and OJ has been involved in this all along. We've been making our way through Project Catcher Bra, where we're playing 10 different versions of the same battle using different systems, just trying to evaluate them and see what works. One of the systems that has impressed me dramatically is Sam Mustafa's LaSalle 2. And I know that a lot of the players really liked it. And I think the secret of it is that sucker is polished. And by that, I mean, not only is it cleanly written, not only is it clearly written, but Sam made some hard choices about things that gamers, especially Naps nerds like me, we like to have in our rules. And Mike, even though he's not really a Napoleonic gamer, he's already had me beat him over the head with these so many times, he could probably talk about them. Things like retreats, or things like the terrain effects of marching troops, you know, the effect of marching troops through terrain. Sam purges so much, and he does it fearlessly, and he does it unapologetically. And it's such a, I'm not saying it's the best game of its kind, but it's really freaking good. And one of the reasons is because it does that. And especially now as we've entered a new era of gaming, of game design, I'm expecting to see more of that, to be honest.
I think one of the reasons Sam can get away with that is, if you don't like the fact that he abstracts out all that terrain stuff, go play something else. It's not like you lack for options.
Oh dear God, yeah, for sure.
Not in the Napoleonic Minis space. No, I think there's others to choose from.
Well, like I say, we've managed to come up with 10 different, and actually there's more. I'm occasionally getting people in the YouTube chat saying, well, are you going to try this one too? Are you going to try this one too? It's like, so we've managed to come up with 10 different ways to play one battle using different Napoleonic systems.
Yeah. So Mike, OJ's dad, what have you seen from some of those different systems? What jumps out at you?
Oh, Lordy. well, we did Snappy Nappy this last weekend, right? And it's a very basic, simple rule set. And then you got, I like Blucher a lot, but there's some complexity in there that you sometimes sit there and wonder about, right?
Blucher's the one you used for Leipzig, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And I'll be honest, there's times when I get some of these things confused because we're changing rule sets so often. I'm not keeping up with all the changes.
We got another one for you next week, so here we go.
Yeah, oh Lordy. No wonder I'm bald and gray. Oh, wait a minute. That was before.
Does it feature monkeys in treaties?
Yep. Honestly, I took about a month off. I just things going on here at home and stuff. I wasn't able to join for about a month. Did we do LaSalle 2 yet?
Yep.
Jim? We did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did. And I know I'm sitting here saying, did we do it or not? But I do recall that now that, yes, I did like that set. And as Jim said, it simplified a lot of things. So
yeah. Yeah. I think for those of us watching at home, those differences are, I don't want to say they're less apparent. They're not always as immediately apparent because we're not experiencing them in the same way you guys are. I think it would take a lot of really sort of sitting down and paying the kind of close attention that you guys are while playing in order to fully grasp a lot of those complexities that you guys are experiencing just for us at home watching. I think some of the scaling makes sense, but I think for a lot of us, really, it's a lot more about how the battle itself is unfolding than necessarily what the rules are doing to you during the battle. Because as we've been watching Project Quatre Bras, one of the cool things about it is because you're playing the same battle, what is it, six times now? I think you've gone through six iterations at this point. Mm-hmm. No, I think there have been two of them that were sort of kind of similar, and the rest of them are all pretty widely divergent. And so for us, it's more about watching the different tactics being used and the different ways in which the battle is unfolding much more than it is the rules system as the audience guys on the outside looking in.
No, that makes sense.
So, and that's, you know, in large part, cause we're not experiencing it the same way you guys are. We're not having to do the internal math of, okay, these rules give me this limitation. And so I can only do this much of the thing that I want to do before I run out of an opportunity. And so that's, we're seeing the tactical results of those decisions that you guys are having to make based on sort of what's going on in the rules there. But
so the question I have, because this is, it's a fascinating concept to me, really, to actually do something like that. But are you taking notes, and is there going to be some kind of a there's so many ways you could take this. So many, I guess you could come at this from so many angles. I mean, are you looking at, does each system really give a good experience with the battle that you're playing? Is there one rule set that does something better than another rule set? What is the end goal here?
Well, I will first observe, I think Brandt has published 3 of my AARs to that front page that nobody ever goes to.
Oh, he has. No. Yeah,
so I wasn't going to say it. I was going to let somebody else bring it up.
Yeah, so I have actually written 3 AARs. I actually owe Brandt 4, 5, and 6. 4 and 5 are pretty quick because they're Commands and Colors and Napoleon's Last Battles, which I felt obligated to do.
Actually, what I think you owe me, I think you skipped the number in there somewhere. I think you owe me 4 and 6 because I think you've already done 5.
Okay.
Although I'm not sure. I know you skipped the number in there somewhere.
Okay.
These are individual AARs for the games you play for the systems there. I'm talking about, are you going to get to the end of all these systems and all these playthroughs and then do some sort of comparison amongst
the games you play? That,
he better. He told me he was going to.
Yeah, that is a great point, and the answer is yes. I very much want to do that because I think that's sort of part of the point. The whole Project Contra Brau experience came from 2 things. Number one, I was upset that they've torn down the last vestige of the battlefield out there.
Yeah.
That was really, really stupid. But number two, I really kind of wanted to figure out which Napoleonic battle set I like the most.
Yeah.
You know,
and you're going to make everybody else be your crash test dummies for that.
Yes, and? You know, and so I'm going to spend hour upon hour. I mean, I'm going to take a quick peek here and see, but I'm pretty sure that my tabletops, I am now at 2,240 hours in Tabletop Simulator. You know, I'm going to spend hour upon hour building these things and then have other people, you know, perform, show me monkey, show me, speaking of monkeys and trees, and run them through these different rule sets and see which ones they like and see which ones they enjoy the most and which ones. But then to Mike's point, you've got the one that is, this was the best game. We had the most fun. And I would say right now, although we really did have a blast playing Napoleon's Last Battles, that was Vance and OJ, actually.
Yeah,
Vance and OJ.
He wiped the board with me both sides of the table.
Yeah, we actually had enough time to play that both ways. And I always do like, and I will always like, Commands and Colors, Napoleonics. They're different games. So far, the game of substance is pretty much been LaSalle 2 and a walk. The people really got into it and liked it. Yeah. But that's from a game perspective. Then there's the question of which of them felt the most like Contra Brau.
Yeah.
You know, we've all, you know, well, I won't say we all have, but certainly if you love the period, you've read a lot of accounts of Contra Brau, you know what happened. Which of these looked the most like it? And that's the neat thing about the folks that kibitz with us on Saturday Night Fights, the viewers on YouTube, because some of these guys are they're Napoleonic obsessives like me, and they got real strong opinions, and they say which ones they think look the best. So I think, you know, melding all that is absolutely part of the plan here.
Yeah, and I think you're going to have so much material when you go sit down to do that melding that you're going to have enough for a book. And I'll buy that book, of course, because I want to read it. It's going to be good.
No, it's it's a lot of fun. And I do love the fact that by and large, yes, I have people that are passionate about Napoleonics, that like Napoleonics, but some that aren't. And none of them are rules experts. These are just people coming at it with an open mind. And I think that's just great.
Yeah. I think that is one of the cool things about watching Saturday Night Fights is nobody's trying to rules lawyer their way through stuff. They're out there to have a good time and to, you know, play some games with friends learn some history, learn some rules, but they're not trying to rules lawyer their way through things. And that's been one of the nicer things about watching. So
no, I will always take as one of my proudest comments. It was from a game that Mike played in, actually. It was one of our Sharp Practice games. Richard Clark, who wrote Sharp Practice, came on and posted and said, you know, you guys play the way I think people should play.
That's cool.
And that's a very nice thing for him to say, and I think it's true. So I think it makes for far better viewing when people aren't being jerks to each other.
You know, Jim kind of touched on this, and where, as an example, Saturday night, I think the snappy-nappy rule system, I like that a lot. But I don't know that the scenario was the best design scenario.
Right.
We talked about this quite a bit at the end there. It really required a French player to be extremely aggressive right off the bat.
So totally not at all within French character.
Well, I think it really forces a certain
playing style. At this point.
No, but my point is that I think it really forces a certain playing style. And if you don't do that from turn one, you're going to struggle to be victorious as the French player.
Yeah. And that's actually, if I have a frustration and it's a good one to have, I've put a pin in a couple scenarios to go, I want another crack at this one. You know, I want to try this again. Maybe I'll play it with Velker sometime, or maybe, you know, I'll jump online with Mike sometime just to try it again. And one of those is absolutely snappy nappy because I love that rule set. I think it's imperfect. It's an imperfect gem is what I would call it. It is where Blücher is tight and well made and carefully drawn. Snappy nappy is very much that ill-dressed, maybe he's got pizza stains on his sweater, beer drinking uncle that you love to show up at your house every now and again because you know you're going to have a good time, even if there are some rough edges there.
That's a heck of a way to put it.
It's the way I feel about it. I mean, there are some times that rule set absolutely made me pound my head against the wall. And I got a hold of the author, who I happen to know a little bit, and I said, wait a minute, what's the movement rate for commanders? And he went, oh yeah, I probably should have put that in the rules. I said, can units interpenetrate? That should be there too. And it doesn't make me love the rules any less. It absolutely doesn't. I think they're fabulous. I'd recommend them to anybody. But stuff like that, you just got to build it into your expectations.
I think part of that goes back to David and Stennis' point of many of the Napoleonic rules, especially as they were initially conceived in a variety of convention games, right? We're using this guy's rule set, but we borrowed some of the combat tables from this other book, and we totally threw out the logistics model, and we're using this other guy's logistics model in order to be able to properly use all the figures from this other company, except for the cavalrymen, because they've got the correct square buttons, you know, rotated 45 degrees, so they look like diamonds. So we're going to use those guys' cavalry. And so, you know, it's like a 1970s computer that you built out of spare parts from Radio Shack instead of being a coherent game.
Well, so now
everybody's
now
having fun with it.
Three or four podcasts, though.
Yes. Yes,
we've had this discussion.
But it's
probably more than three or four.
It's that car that Johnny Cash built in that song. You know, but David particularly, well, look, anybody at this point in the evolution of this hobby, anybody that puts out a Napoleonic rule set, a World War II tactical set, has got to be 80 flavors of freaking nuts.
Yeah.
Because that field is so jammed. And I'm not even talking about the millions of rules. Just go on Wargame Vault and Google and hit up Napoleonic rules and tell me what you see. You know, it's to make us the fact that Sam was able to reach so many with LaSalle and that David has done so well with Essence Resultat is a statement to the love, the reverence that Sam has held in, and justly. And the fact that David has just been willing to lean into this so hard and commit himself to marketing it and to being the face of it and building Essence Resultat into what it is, because you talk about a crowded field. And that doesn't even allow for the guys, some of whom I know very well, who have never left their old game behind that nobody talks about anymore. On Saturday night, we're going to be playing Shaco 2, one of my all-time favorite rule sets. Those guys, you know, the guys that Dave Wextel and Artie Conliff brought into the game 20 years ago, they haven't left. That's what they're still playing.
Isn't the Shaco 2 rule set coming close to 30 years at this point?
Shaco 1 might be, where I had my rule set right here. It's not okay. Quite that old. Shaco 1 was Artie Conliff's response to Empire.
Okay.
I think all of Artie's rules are out, and I really should call him Mr. Conliff. It's not like I know him. he's autographed my Shaco book.
Did he sign it Mr. Conlin or did he sign it Artie?
No, Artie. Yeah. He signed it Artie.
Well,
you know, I got all my, most of my rules are autographed now that I think about it. But my point being, I think a lot of Artie stuff was done sort of on a dare. You know, that's certainly how we built, you know, when he did Crossfire, people said, you can't build a World War II tactical game that doesn't involve any measuring. And so we did. You don't need a ruler to play Crossfire, which really disturbs a lot of my friends who play World War II tactical games. But anyway, you know, so you got people playing Column, Line, and Square. You got people playing Empire. You got people playing all this stuff.
Which version of Empire, though?
Oh, okay. Everybody plays Empire 2.
Except for the guys that really, really, really believe that Empire 3 is where
yes,
it's at.
Yes, and those people assuredly exist. Or the people who believe that Republic to Empire is the best one. So
it's Shaco funny to hear David and Stennis talk about that, though, because there was a very amusing talk he gave on one of the podcasts many, many moons ago, talking about it's funny to get Napoleonic minis gamers together, you know. Hey, what are you interested in? Oh, I'm a big fan of Napoleon, you know, Napoleonic minis. Oh, really? Me too. Which period do you like? Well, you know, I really like the campaigns through Prussia in the, you know, the late 1800s. Really? Me too. That's awesome. You know, and you know, what kind of scale do you like to play? Well, me too. That's great. Which rule system do you prefer? I generally play Empire 2. Oh, man, I play Empire 3. We got nothing in common, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Shaco 1, amazing to me. Shaco 1 came out in 1995.
Mm. Yep. And 2 came out in 2008.
Yeah, so these guys are – and 2 was a huge deal because Artie didn't necessarily want to do it. But Dave Wextel sort of insisted and kind of bought it from him. Because Shaco 2, what it is it's the errata. More relevantly, it's the frequently asked questions for Shaco 1.
Sometimes that's enough to get you a second edition, man.
You know, it's like it, but if you go to the Avalon Napoleonic Fellowship out of England, they're wonderful guys. If you go there, they still play Shaco 1 with their modifications. That's what they play.
Yeah.
So again, it's not like that space was all, you know, the number of guys that want to paint up 25 or 15 or 6 or 10 or whatever millimeter guys and put them on an expensive, you know, railroad quality table to spend 8 hours playing a Napoleonic miniatures game. That field is already pretty teeny tiny. It's already pretty jammed up with guys playing their rules. So if you're going to put that out there, boy, oh boy, you best be ready for some noise.
So let's further subdivide it with another set of rules.
Right. Exactly. And also be prepared to be told your rules suck. And precisely why. I have good friends who just can't imagine that anybody would play something smaller than 15 millimeter.
And then you have others that probably can't imagine anyone playing anything larger.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, I'm good Twitter friends with the guy who hosts the podcast known as God's Own Scale. And he's talking about 6 millimeter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, you know, there's so many different views. There's so many different points. It amazes me we agree on anything. And honestly, if you go to Historicon, that there are two things that'll happen. You'll get a few drifters like me who love playing different rule sets and will bounce from place to place. If indeed I wind up getting to go to Historicon and they sort everything out in Pennsylvania by November in time, I'm going to do the same thing. Velker and I are going to bounce from table to table just playing different Napoleonic sets. But you get a few drifters, but really it's the opportunity for the guys to really love their set to set up a table and force others to play with them, which, by the way, don't tell anybody, is sort of the secret of Saturday Night Fights.
I promise we won't tell anybody that isn't already hearing it on this podcast.
There you go.
Which means we're pretty much not telling anybody, so it'll be fine.
Well, our many dozen of listeners.
Yes. Yes. When you mentioned the podcast and, you know, are we going to talk about the European Super League? You know, we'll alienate our two remaining listeners.
There you go.
So, Mike, BB Mike, next thing that that you're going to be playing.
Well, unfortunately, the Great Crisis of Frederick II, because I have yet to finish it. I've actually got an update coming out tomorrow. I did accelerate the playthrough, but I need to just spend a day with it and just knock it off the tabletop. I've got so much stuff queued up that it's not even funny anymore.
Unfortunately, it's a game you're supposed to be having fun with. What do you mean, unfortunately?
You know, I actually am having fun with it, and I'll go into an overview when I finish it, a review. And then on the computer, I'm looking at something called Warplan Pacific, which is really interesting.
Gee, somehow, who saw a Pacific Theater war game crossing BB Mike's computer screen there? So the
is now. Sir, I know you're making a joke, but I was actually going to ask: is that your wheelhouse? Would you say
World War II Pacific?
Yeah,
I don't know if I'd call it my wheelhouse, but it's definitely on the boat.
Okay,
it's one of the big ones. I love. So yeah, World War II Pacific I like. I like American Revolution, sometimes Civil War. What else? Gosh.
It just seems that every time a World War II something comes up, the first thing that happens is BB Mike says, "When's the Pacific expansion coming out?"
Yeah.
Where's the Pacific Theater?
So how did we not have you buy for our Valiant Bayonet game of cow pens? Come on now.
I don't know.
I have to fire that one up again. Because I actually have seen that. We played that, what, Mike, twice now? And I think it's been a lot of fun each time.
Yeah, we use the volley and bayonet rule set. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
All right, so BB Mike is down to play. Just making a note here.
I actually have what is this? It's Rebels and Patriots. Isn't that a miniature?
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
I have that. And actually, because of you, I own a copy of Blücher now, too. I don't know why, but I do.
Well, you got to come by and play. Well, gosh, we play Blücher all the bloody time. I've threatened many times, we're going to turn the Saturday Night Fights into the Blücher channel. So. But it's,
you mean you hadn't already?
Right. Well, we did. As you so sardonically put it, we did spend 39 hours playing Leipzig. So
it's less that you guys spent 39 hours playing Leipzig than I spent about 37 and a half of them watching Leipzig.
Yeah, well, a lot of folks, and actually it's more than 39 hours because a couple times we went 4 hours long. So,
yeah, the secret to getting through those.
We had two types of people watching us. We had those that really wanted to watch the battle, watch the Blücher and so forth. And we had one or two people that just didn't have a life on Saturday night and nothing else to do.
Yeah.
Right.
The opportunity to sit around and drink with us.
Yeah. I wish.
Well, let's be honest, and we have before, and we have justly praised Gary for this already. I mean, come on, the guy figured out people wanted to watch him drink and clip counters and shoot the stuff.
Yes, he set a new viewership record last night with high simultaneous viewers. So crazy. He's consistently getting over triple digits at this point, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, no, and it's great because it's a good conversation. He knows his stuff. And it just shows that there's a hunger for decent content out there.
Yeah.
But no, yeah, Rebels and Patriots. I just actually got around to buying Pikeman's Lament from the same system, same guy, Daniel. It's Mersey, I think. It's Daniel Mersey. And I picked that up just because I love that system so much. So I've got all of them. But yeah, Rebels and Patriots is a great skirmish system. And I really should build a American's Revolutionary War example, because it's got some great little scenarios that you can easily play with four people.
I will say that at least one person who went back and viewed some of one of your Cowpen streams is so South Carolina has these guys that work for the State Department of Natural Resources or whatever are sort of combo park rangers slash game wardens.
Here we
this
go.
This one happens to have a long history in Civil War and Revolutionary War reenactment, and family has been in South Carolina since the 1600s, and he rather enjoyed watching one of the Cowpens games that you guys played. Well, so
I'm glad to hear that, because
Cowpens happens to be in his territory also.
Because usually, you know, when you run into those people that had a cousin, you know, their great-great-grandpappy was one of the people that charged at Cowpens through those trees, they tend to be a little hypercritical. So it's just, I always do wonder about that because so much of what I do is over on the other side of the Atlantic.
Yeah.
And I know that when we ran Cowpens the first time, we had a bunch of guys online. Bless them. You know, I love them. I love people who are passionate about things, but who are asking, wait a minute, wasn't that artillery battery attached to that battalion over there?
Yeah.
And, you know, wasn't this, and I had to tell them, I remember distinctly, the guy who wrote the scenario was actually a professor of history at William and Mary. So I went, here's his email address, take it up with him.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that might have been how they started, but as we have moved forward through the battle, I made the change to put that guy over here instead. And that's why he's not where you thought he should be. I'm not reenacting. I'm making my own decisions.
Yeah. God knows why Velker decided to drive that battalion all the way over there. You're going to have to ask him. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think.
Because it was a Cossack unit.
Yeah. It was a dirty bunch of Cossacks.
Because Brant was on the other side of the battlefield and go pick on him instead. That's why.
I was going to say, because when he rolled those dice, Brant got destroyed.
Yeah, you know, Brant, you never get to live that down, right?
No, God, no. I'm leaning into it, man. I am the reason for one of Velker's greatest, you know, virtual triumphs.
Yeah, he actually and I were sitting down trying to pencil out the odds that he was up against and that he overcame.
Oh God, it's ridiculous. I think for my buddy with the Cowpens game, quite frankly, I think he was just happy that somebody was, you know, actually remembering the Battle of Cowpens and that it was important and that there was something tactically meaningful to be explored there. You know, because it's a national battlefield, he doesn't officially work Cowpens, but that area is in his territory. And so he swings by quite a bit and knows the folks that work the battlefield. I've actually been there. It's, you know, been 16, 17 years since I was there, but I have been there and walked the ground and they've done a decent job of sort of keeping the foliage in place similar to where it was way back when. So when you're standing on the hill looking at, you know, where the charge was coming from, it's not like the trees have suddenly shown up over the last 200 years. I mean, they've kept it cleared so that it looked like it did back then, like the cow pens that were there. And you're looking at that and you're thinking, you're trying to imagine just how full of, you know, smoke and uniforms and dust and everything else was out there, and you got some pretty good sight lines. I mean, you can see a long damn way on most of that battlefield, and you're just looking at it going, wow, I mean, this whole area full of a battle, it's pretty impressive to see.
We've got a gentleman who watches us pretty regularly by the name of John Stanley, who is, he's one of my people who will goad me into, hey, Jim, could we do this battle? Could we do this battle? And I got to wind up looking it up and researching it and see if we get a suitable rule set. But I love that. I love
his use of we when he's not playing in the battle.
Well, right. And it's like, I've said, John, do you want to play? He's like, no, I just really don't have the time, but I love to watch and I love to know what's going on. He got us to play, it's not Frigate. It was the other one. The ship-to-ship game that we played, and it actually worked very, very well, that we all enjoyed immensely. Fighting Sail, that was it. Yeah. He got us to play Cowpens. He got us to play one of the Fletcher Pratt games.
He likes for us to do naval games.
Yeah, and we're going to do a Fletcher Pratt. We'll do a Fletcher Pratt very, very soon, I think.
So, BB Mike, if there is a Pacific Theater naval battle you really want to see, we need to reach out to John Stanley to have him go Jim into doing it. The appropriate chain of events to make this happen is let me call John's childhood friend from the mountain town in southwestern Virginia that grew up with him, who happens to live here in town with me and is one of my wife's best friends.
Is that right?
Yes. I will call Aaron to call John to tell Jim to go do something. Yeah, because I got a friend request for him for social media, and I'm looking at that, and the two mutual friends that I had with him were you and Aaron here in town. And I'm like, how the hell did this happen?
That is so awesome.
Oh, it was completely bat crap crazy. And so I call up Aaron. I'm like, I'm just curious, like, why you would know this guy. And she's like, why do you know him? She's like, I went to 11 years of school with this guy. Why the hell do you know him? So I'm having to explain it.
Yeah, for
it's
those
wargaming thing.
Who aren't following the narrative, John just showed up at Saturday Night Fights one time.
And hasn't left yet.
And hasn't left yet. And he's a regular and he loves to hang out. And look, I love the fact that people are passionate enough about their battles to want to play them, to want to see them represented, to want to find an interesting scenario. So that, as we've said a million times, as much as I love it, we don't always have to play Waterloo or Gettysburg or the Bulge, you know?
No, you just, you know, Leipzig.
Hey, come on. We're in a pretty elite group of people who can legitimately say they played the whole darn thing at the brigade level
in real time.
Yeah. Let's now I got to think about it. I don't know as I thought about it that way, but if it's 43 hours, no, that's slower than the real battle. The real battle took less time.
There was probably a little less frivolity at the real battle as well.
Yeah, there was much less talk about no touchy fish and all the other stuff.
Yeah. All right, so Jim, what is next on Saturday Night Fights, and what is next not on Saturday Night Fights?
Gosh, we got a lot. We've actually added stuff as we're recording tonight on a Tuesday. Tomorrow on a Wednesday, I'm going to be getting together with the Command Tent, one of our regulars, as well as Vance Barthart. They're going to be doing Battle 3 in the Two Fat Lardies Chain of Command, Storming the Citadel, Operation Kursk. Right now, Vance is taking it to CT, and it's bad, bad, bad. And a little hint, folks, it's entirely possible that Vance brought a tank. So we'll see what CT brought to respond. Then on Saturday, we've got Project Hatra-Bra Part 7 with Shaco 2. That's going to go a little bit longer because we got to teach the rules, and it's more detailed, and it's a little more fiddle.
Is this going to be a multi-weekend?
Yeah, I'm thinking probably 2, maybe 3, but more likely 2. Because once everybody gets in the rhythm, Shaco moves very quickly, actually. Already built it specifically to respond to Empire. To say you don't have to take this long to play. You just don't. And so
you're going to prove him right or wrong by taking several weekends to play.
It depends who plays. It depends who plays. But I know Mike will be there. And this is a crew that knows each other pretty well. So I'm optimistic. And then the big one, and I'll let the cat out of the bag for those who have seen it. I tried and failed to run a Kriegsspiel based on Snappy Nappy's 1809 campaign. It failed for a lot of reasons I won't go into here. But because Dalinor, Ron, our friend, our usual Napoleon, goaded me into it, there's a theme. Because he goaded me into it,
he didn't
goad
you into anything.
You stop. You stop.
I was there.
He did so. Quit being his witness.
So by goading, what we really mean is he asked politely.
Well, no, he actually kind of poked at this thing and went, Jim, I bet you could do it. I bet you could do this. And it turns out I did, and I could. I have built the entire 1809 campaign onto a single game board. It's 26 feet by 16 feet.
I was about to ask, how big is a game board?
Because TTS hasn't had any trouble staying up and running prior to this, right?
The question that I was going to ask is it actually scaled properly?
Yes.
Okay, are we sure?
Oh, that way? Yeah. No, I don't know for sure. Not that way. How come you got to join the jerk parade? Hey. For those who don't understand
the joke. I'm the drum major, man. What do you mean?
We figured it out the other night. It was the one time Jim's wife did not help him set up the board.
What happened?
Yeah. That's what we kind of determined there.
So you're blaming her?
100%.
No. We're blaming Jim for not letting his wife help.
Right. Okay. No, for those who don't know what these degenerates are talking about, I built the first part of Project Hatra-Bra was for Blücher, and I built it and we played the scenario. And as we were playing the scenario, it was weird because nobody was getting close. The two sides were just in no way engaging with each other. And we stared at it and stared at it and stared at it. And people started to get a sense. And finally, I took out, I forget what triggered it, but something happened that I went, wait a minute, how big is this table? And I measured it and I built it literally twice as big as it should have been.
Yeah.
And consequently, we went back the very next week and we played it and we made it through and it was great. But I will say this, that if you have a chance to watch the YouTube video, especially towards the end where it's discovered the mistake I've made, it is literally one of the funniest things I've ever been involved in.
Yeah.
Particular credit, because you have to imagine these units attempting to advance across a field and advance and advance and advance and advance and never get there. Particularly the moment where Doug made the comment that it was very much like that scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail with Lancelot charging across the field and never getting there.
I was sitting here trying to think. It reminded me of something, and that was it. That's
what you yeah, that sense of, and then the cutaway to the guards not doing anything.
Yeah,
that was it. No, it was
those guys wouldn't have gotten in range on rollerblades as big as that table.
No, it was incredibly funny. But going to your earlier point about the spirit, you know, the guys were great sports about it. They had a great sense of humor about it. We just had a blast and got back to it the next week. So. We will be, I don't know how we're going to do it, because to Mike's point, this is, you talk about the hairy edge of what Tabletop Simulator wants to do. I've got 3,000 minis on a table 26 feet by 17 feet, and I've got all the terrain. I've got all the cities. I've got Regensburg built like a little fort, and I'm going to try to put 6 people, I think, on it simultaneously playing in the same game.
And you're jacking into the UNIVAC over at the University of Wisconsin to run it, right?
This is, well, that's sort of it. And I'm warning people. But no, it's the thought that Dalinor has. And who knows? Maybe this is what we decide to do. That when it comes to the Dragoons Online, everybody takes Friday off and we spend the whole day Friday just playing that.
Yeah.
So it's not really Tabletop Simulator you're stressing. It's the bandwidth.
Well, we've had a lot of discussion about that. And obviously Mike's the, you know, OJ is the computer guy on our little group, but it's a little bit of your computer, but it's mostly my bandwidth, I think, that it really pings. But we've had one or two people who have just had horrific connections, and it really does kill the whole experience. So we got to be a little careful. But with this, this is all bets are off. You had best come with a decent computer or it is not happening.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it is not. Are you
going to post system requirements for this?
Yeah. This is, well, no, my plan actually, to tell you the whole honest truth, is to tell the folks, yeah, log in and tell me how it works for you before we let you play.
Guys, we are rapidly approaching the usual time that we start to wrap up these episodes of the podcast, but not calling it over just quite yet. I am sort of curious. We're coming up on 2.5-ish years, not quite up to 3 years yet. Of the Dragoons, but as we are wrapping up season 6 of the podcast, we're getting pretty close to hitting 3 years on the Dragoons here. Looking back over the last handful of years of since the Dragoons were founded and we mustered the regiment into existence, to continue our Dragoons metaphor, way beyond its useful life. What do you think is one of our bigger successes, and what do you think is one of those places where we still need to improve? We're going to engage in some public self-criticism here. OJ's dad, what do you think where have we succeeded and hit the mark for the kinds of things we originally set out to do, and where do you think we've still got some work that we need to double down on and get back to work on?
I think
he's going first, so he's going to mull it over. But the other two, well, of y'all get a second to think about it.
Yeah,
so.
I think Saturday Night Fights is, you know, Jim leading that has been probably your biggest success to date, I would say. And that's not a criticism of anything else that's done. I think it's kind of hard to tell, because we kind of hit on this the other day with a couple of us, right? Where somebody made a comment that things didn't seem to be as active on the forums and stuff. And I think it was you, Brant, that kind of pointed out, you know, it's that way across the board on a lot of things. And it's hard to tell how much of this whole COVID thing for the last year is just wearing people down.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I won't just say wearing down, but just putting people in a funk, right? where they're just not as active on some of these things anymore. I almost want to say they've been so active for the last year because that's been their outlet that they're just kind of like, hey, it's 70 some degrees out. Winter's over. I can go outside right now. I'm going to go do some other stuff.
Yeah. I think so it's probably been some screen fatigue.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's that valid thoughts. I definitely appreciate it. So, Mike, what do you think?
One of the things, well, there's a couple of things that I think we set out to do that, and one of the things that comes to mind are the forums. And I think a place to go where you can just, you know, talk about wargaming and, well, really computer games too, I guess, but wargaming and just talk about wargaming and nothing else. And I think we've got the people that post there. I mean, everybody, there's rarely will you see anybody's temper flare or anything. So I think we've done a good job of building a community where it's a friendly community and it's very accepting of anybody, really. And the other thing is, I think some of the articles, Tuesday Newsday, I think is for me is one of my favorite things on the site on that front page you were talking about earlier.
You're just kissing up now.
No, I mean I think that was kind of neat, and I think where we can do better is maybe do more content like that, more. Just some different things. And I think we're actually headed towards that right now. I think we've got, you know, like Mike said, Saturday Night Fights out there. We've got the designer questions that come out that are kind of neat to read through. So I think we're doing better, but there's
so audience, we could use some, you know, some more writers, anybody interested in throwing some words our way and wanting to join our crew for helping generate some of that content. I say writers, content in general. Video folks are perfectly welcome to join us as well. But the writing has kind of been sort of the bread and butter behind it all. So,
and I would say don't even scare people away. I would say even if it's a one-off article you want to submit.
Oh, hell yeah. No, we've done a bunch of different one-offs where a couple of times we've had some people approach us. A couple of times we've reached out to some folks and said, hey, you know, we saw this really interesting conversation you were having through whatever social media location or other forum. Is that something you'd be interested in building out into an article? And we've gotten some pretty cool stuff out of that. The article about the Brotherhood and Unity game is one of those, as a for instance. We've gotten a couple of pretty cool ones. And then, you know, we had what started as a one-off turn into – you know, our buddy, the Rocky Mountain Navy, writing a whole ton of stuff for us over the last year, roughly. So it's worked out pretty well. Yeah. Jim, what do you think? Where have we had some successes and where have we completely gacked up somewhere along the way or got some room to improve?
I think the success has been in building a community wherever it's from. You know, I'm always pleased when people come through the Saturday Night Fights or whatever, but that's not the only place to be sure. They've come from a lot of different places and letting people know this is a place they can come talk about gaming, spend some time away from all this stuff. And it's strange because you would think that at a time like this, people would want more time away, but I think you're right. I think that there is a sense of ugh going on out there, and it can even take energy to get into things you like and spend, you know, things, talk about things you like. But it's been a real joy to see people talk about, hey, I like this type of game. Does anybody else? And to see somebody on the forums respond, I do. I like that too. You know, that's really cool. And there isn't enough of that. And to be very direct, I'm not sure that there isn't too much, hey, look at this new product we're selling. I'll show you how to play it. Or here's, and that's nothing wrong with that, but when your content is solely about moving current product, I think you miss a lot of things because there's a lot of people out there that are just playing, like, for example, our guy, Jeff, War1221, regular on Saturday Night Fights. He doesn't really like one of the mainline World War II games. He likes Cross of Iron, which is sort of an off brand. Well, stuff that isn't that way is directed away from him. I want to run games and see games and have forum games for whatever people want to play, new or old. And I think we've done that. I think that's really cool. On the space, well, I would say on the improvement side, let's do more of it. But I am also in agreement, and I don't know where this is because I got into this very briefly with Bruce Garrick online. I don't know where people are in terms of how they want their gaming information. And I'm not saying it's got to be either or, but I am curious, would people rather have a video? Do they rather have a podcast? Do they rather You know, so just take one example. The LaSalle 2 rules come out. How do people want to hear about that? Do you want an article that's written with pictures? Do you want a video that sort of runs through it as gives you a few examples and gives you a detailed flip through? Or do you want us just to play a game of it? Or do you want there to be a podcast where we talk about it? You
know, or all of the above.
Or all of the above, right. Like I say, it's not an either or. But where are people in terms of what they want? And I'd be very interested in hearing more of that. You know, how do you want to get your gaming information? You know, I've said, borrowing the line from John Prine, you know, I could have me a million more friends. All I'd have to lose is my point of view. I could probably have a million more viewers on YouTube. I'd probably just have to edit a video. You know, but it's, so I'm going to do what I'm going to do. But I would be curious to know, other than that, how do people want to get info? You know, how do they prefer it and be more responsive and reactive to that?
It's something that I'm curious about as well, because part of it is probably my bad. It's one of those things of, do I love it because it's my background, or did I, you know, study it in my background because I loved it so much? But it's no secret I'm a huge fan of the written word, and yep. I enjoy a well-written, longer, extended article, whether it is a good detailed review of something or a broader analysis piece or a historical comparison piece or historical companion piece. Even just the occasional sort of semi-rambling op-ed, if it's well-written, I'm happy to read it. I am not necessarily a huge fan of a lot of the videos. I think the videos that are my preference tend to be ones that have my friends in them, in part because it's the closest we're going to get to hanging out right now. And so I think that's one of the reasons why Gary's counterclipping streams are as popular as they are. It is just hanging out with a friend, with, you know, some friends in the chat, and you'll see conversations going on in the chat that have nothing to do with what's being discussed on the stream. Quite frankly, it happens in Saturday Night Fights quite a bit. That's how the whole French monkeys and trees thing came about this past week with the French guys wandering off into the woods. There was a whole separate Eddie Izzard side conversation that grew up in the YouTube chat. For me, the videos, if it's not somebody that I know and I'm friends with, I'm less likely to watch them. And that's not an indictment of the guys making the videos. That's just my consumption preference. I don't listen to a ton of other podcasts. I listen to ours because I got to cut the production together. But I don't listen to a ton of other podcasts. I listen to a couple here and there. I actually listen to a couple of sports podcasts, but not a lot of other wargaming ones. I want to read stuff, and that's my preference. And so it may be that I lean a little too far in that direction in terms of what I prefer or what I recruit for our content. If folks are, you know, digging the videos and, you know, they like watching Saturday Night Fights, they like watching the stuff that Mike's putting together with My Own Worst Enemy, fine. Let's find some people to help us do more of that. But I'm of a similar curiosity in that, what is it that people want? What can we deliver to keep them interested and engaged? I think one of the things that's definitely been different with the Dragoons is for several previous incarnations, not just our immediate stop before this one, but several before that as well, it was sort of forums or nothing, right? It was the forum community and forums uber alles. And if we're not having conversations in the forums, then what are we even doing here? I think we've definitely broken that mold. And Saturday Night Fights is one of several ways in which that has happened. We've got a lot more interaction with people on Twitter than we ever did anywhere else before. We've got people that show up and play in our convention games, digital or in person, that aren't forum regulars or podcast listeners necessarily, but they are religious players with us. They're with us all the time, sitting down to play games. Whether it's Jim's Kriegspiels or showing up with us at the ACDCs or at Origins or whatever. So people have found a variety of ways to engage with us, not just, you know, a single mode and that's all we offer. And I think that's kind of cool. I think that's something that wasn't intentionally developed, but kind of grew organically. And sometimes those are the best ways to do things, is to just sort of let stuff start and see where it goes. And that's, it's kind of worked out for us, intentionally or otherwise. Guys, I appreciate y'all being available, especially on fairly short notice here, as the original plans for the end towards the, you know, getting towards the end of season six kind of fell apart, and we sort of pieced this together from here. But this is, it's been a lot of fun. I suspect simply because it become an unintentional annual tradition, there will be some sort of special episode of the podcast in the middle of the summer. Intentional or otherwise, we just seem to have done that the last few years, and we'll probably do it again. But otherwise, Mention and Dispatches will return sometime in the fall once the leaves start to change and the Germans invade Belgium on their way to France. We will probably come back with season 7 of Mention and Dispatches, and no doubt these guys will be with us. In the meantime, Jim, I'm figuring you're not taking a 2-week summer hiatus to go meandering about Bavaria this year. So probably just going to play Saturday Night Fights straight through the summer, huh?
Yep. I was sincerely hoping, actually, the next stop for us will be Dresden, which is Lützenbautzen and Dresden, which are some of the great battles of the, 1813 campaign, but unfortunately Germany has done a remarkable job of screwing up its vaccine rollout. So
yeah.
All of Europe has.
Fair enough.
No, yes. I'm sorry.
Except Britain.
Yes. And the EU unfortunately is hitting like 650,000 dead, you know.
It's a horrible thing. It is. The fact that it inconveniences my travel is so far down the list I can't see it from where I'm standing.
Yeah,
but it's out of the question.
So. We'll go visit Bob in Newcastle.
There we go. Britain's got it sorted. And it's funny. You know, you talk about the blessings of Tabletop Simulator, Steam Chat, and Saturday Night Fights. We got a tour. We got to go visit Bob up in Newcastle. We got to go visit Ian. And now we got to get the straight scoop tomorrow at Wednesday Night Warfare from our local correspondent for Real Madrid.
Giorgio.
Our guy, Giorgio.
Yeah.
Find out what he thinks. So
it's already falling apart. That should be an interesting conversation.
I'm sure it will be.
and the Americans all got blamed for it too.
They did. Well, they got blamed for thinking it up.
And quite frankly, they should have. They did it. It was their fault. And, you know, quit monkeying around with stuff you clearly don't quite understand.
I'm trying to figure out though how we got blamed for it.
Because the guys driving the train behind the big clubs in England making those decisions are all Americans.
So all these big clubs are owned by Americans? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, several of them. Yeah, Arsenal, okay. Arsenal and Man U and Liverpool are all owned by Americans.
And those are the two that dropped out already?
No, Chelsea bailed.
Oh, Chelsea.
And Man U did.
Man City.
Oh, Man City. Okay.
Manchester City, owned by the Kuwaitis. Is it the Qataris? Yep. The Kuwaitis.
I believe they're
one of the Kuwaitis. One of the oil Gulf states owns Man City, and Chelsea is owned by an expat Russian oligarch, which is why they've been known as Chelsky for any number of years.
Yeah, the Man City is owned by Mansour bin Zayed Al Nahyan, also known as Sheikh Mansour.
Liverpool is owned by Fenway Sports Group. You can guess who else they own. Glazers own Man U. They also happen to own the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And Stan Kroenke owns Arsenal, and he also has the LA Rams and the Denver Nuggets. And I think he's still got the Colorado MLS franchise. And I don't know, but I at one point he was at least a part owner of the Colorado Avalanche. I don't know if he still is. So you've got three American, you know, regular sports moguls that are three of the six guys in England kind of driving the three of the six clubs in England that were really driving towards this whole European Super League. And in essence, they don't want to have the possibility of losing their seat at the big boy table in the Champions League by not playing well enough, which Arsenal is not this year, as a for instance. And so if we create this new Champions League alternative called the Super League, and we are guaranteed permanent places in it, then it doesn't matter how well we play. We're always going to be there. We've always got that guaranteed revenue stream. So,
which is funny because I always thought the best thing about British soccer, and I don't know the rest of the European side, was the whole relegation.
They all do it, and that's one of the most important things, and that is there from the top to the bottom. Right. If you play well enough, you can get all the way into the Champions League. Yeah. And what these guys were proposing was a closed alternative to the Champions League, where the 12 or 15 founding clubs are never in danger of dropping out of it. And everybody else is saying, nah, man, that ain't good enough. You know,
Which club did Elton John own at one time?
I'm not sure.
Was it Man U or Man City? It was one of those two. But when he bought them, they were like a dumpster fire, you know, in the bottom of the he put enough money into it that within a few years they were playing for championships at the top
Watford.
Level. What's that?
Watford.
Watford? Okay. For some reason, I was thinking Man U or Manchester
Man U
ones.
is insanely valuable.
Was back like in the 80s or something.
Yeah, well, actually, he bought it. He became club chairman in 1976.
The closest American analogy, and so, again, at this point, we've lost both of our remaining listeners. The closest American analogy would be, regardless of their on-field performance, the Red Sox and Yankees and Dodgers get to always make the playoffs because they're the Red Sox and the Yankees and the Dodgers, and they're the biggest teams out there. And so we're going to let them in the playoffs no matter how good they are during the regular season. And that's not really the way that whole thing should work. You should have to earn your way in. And just because you've been good for a while doesn't mean you get to have a permanent seat at the table.
See, I would have brought up NCAA college football, but that's just
that's exactly where I was going to go.
Yeah. And that's that honestly has – and there was actually an article on The Athletic about what would a college football super league look like, who would be the teams that you would put in it, and who would get left out. And again, keep in mind that as it was discussed, the super league was going to ultimately be 20 teams, 15 with permanent seats at the table and 5 seats that you could earn your way in. And that sounds kind of cool, except that right now the Champions League is 24 teams and everybody has to earn their way in. And 24, it's 32 teams. I'm sorry, it's 32 teams and everybody has to earn their way in. And so you don't just have a guaranteed seat at the table. If you're not good enough, you don't get to play in it. But the flip side of it is, if you are good enough, it doesn't matter where you come from, you get to fight your way into it. There's a team from Nicosia, Cyprus, that for 2 or 3 straight years made it into the knockout rounds of the Champions League, which is unfathomable. They were in the knockout league, in the knockout rounds, in the Champions League quarterfinals. Like, they won the first round in the knockout rounds more recently than Arsenal has. And Arsenal is one of the proposed Super League clubs, one of these big guys. So it's – the Americans are getting a lot of the blame for it, and quite frankly, rightly so, in this case. So it's – the European sports landscape is very, very different than the American sports landscape, and it's not necessarily a better or worse. It's just different, and they evolved very differently for very understandable reasons if you go back through the evolution. But it's just different, and there's no great analogies from one to the other. But transplanting owners from one to the other doesn't appear to have been a great move either. So,
and remember, we'll see how Patreon, it all unfolds. If you become a patron of Armchair Dragoons, we will cut this part out for you, so you will not have to listen to this sports talk. You will get strictly wargaming news and information.
Man, that's a Patreon strategy. Ladle on things nobody wants to hear.
I will say this, though, Mike, it's a good thing you did mention the Patreon thing, because otherwise I'd be, doing the production work on this and go, oh, crap, I got to edit that in now. So we can tack it in down here at the end of all of this and make sure that we do say thank you to our Patreon supporters who support us at an appropriate level to get the by name shout outs in the in the broadcast. And so, Joseph Knoll and Kevin Bertram, definitely appreciate you guys being here. Pat Garrett, definitely appreciate you being one of our regular supporters here for the Armchair Dragoons. We love you guys. You guys are awesome. We appreciate you guys being here with us. And remember that for those of you who are interested in supporting the Patreon, you don't have to support us at the max level that gets you all the way into being called out by name on the podcast here, that you can support us at a lower level. Right now we have Treb Curry and Kevin and Patrick and Joseph that all support us at that higher end. But we've got guys that are just throwing a buck a month at us just to help cover the costs of the production work and the software that we use for this. And so, you know, we appreciate all our supporters. You guys are awesome and we love you. So Mike, thanks for reminding me to get that plug in there at the end of all this. All right, guys, let's call it a night and let OJ get a jump on shoveling snow out there.
Oh no, the weather people promised that if I procrastinate long enough, it'll be gone by noontime tomorrow.
That's the best.
It'll be gone by June. Is that what they said?
Noon.
Oh, I heard June. So, all right, great. BB Mike, thank you for joining us as your in your semi occasional irregular assistant sub co-host duties. Thank you.
No problem. Enjoy it.
And Jim, thank you for jumping in here. Appreciate you being here, especially after having multiple Dragoons commitments over the past week.
Happy to be here.
And Mike, OJ's dad, thank you for being here, especially on the short notice that you were able to fit us into the schedule.
But I could make it.
Fans and friends of the Armchair Dragoons, we really appreciate you joining us for season 6. We're going to have something else fill in that Friday slot for the next couple of months, but we will definitely be back in the fall with season 7 and hope to have all kinds of great tales to tell of our wargaming over the last, over the next few months through the summer of 2021. Everybody stay well. Let's get through the tail end of this pandemic here. Everybody go get your shots and we will all gather for real around real life game tables before too long. And hope that really isn't before too long. So on behalf of the Dragoons, good night, everybody, and we will talk to you all in the fall.